Welcome to that program where we do apologetics, intellectual questions and challenges to the Christian faith. We call it cross defense, and we are glad that you're listening in because we want to prepare all of us to be ready to converse with our unbelieving friends about this wonderful gift that we call Jesus Christ and the faith. To help us do that today, Professor Daniel Dean. He's a professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Irvine, and he's also working on completing a doctorate from Florida State University about the intersection of science and religion. So good for apologetics and cross defense. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Rod. It's good to be here.
Good to hear your voice again. Tell us what good things are going out there at Concordia University, Irvine.
Well, it's we're right in the smack dab middle of our second semester, the spring semester. So it's pretty busy on the professor's end and the student ends as we're getting all our tests graded and first drafts of essays written and things like this. So it's a it's busy over here, but I can't complain because I am sitting in my office looking outside, and I think it's 75 degrees.
Ooh.
Yeah,
we're about 7.5 degrees.
Oh, how about that?
And 3 inches, but it's kind of powdery. It's not that bad, and we'll be on the other end of it. But beautiful campus there, beautiful weather where you are in Irvine. And also, Dan, you're a part of a great new thing, 1517, the Legacy Project. I just love that. And you're a part of that. What do they call that? Thinkers or
the Thinking Fellowship?
The Thinking Fellowship, yeah. You guys publish a lot out there, some great stuff. We're going to talk about a series of articles that you've put out there. What other ones besides the one we're going to talk about do you have posted out there you might like to alert our listeners to go check out?
Sure. Well, my most recent one that I just published was one on Young Earth, Old Earth, What of the Gospel, that just kind of deals from an apologetic point of view, what should we care as much, and I have to be careful saying this because I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but should we care as much about young, old earth when we're discussing and talking and thinking about how to engage the non-believer then we tend to within our own theological circles. You know, the idea being that, there's important questions to raise, but when you're looking at it from the outside, if you put yourself in the shoes of the non-believer, young earth, old earth becomes a stumbling block to any kind of fruitful dialogue between a believer and unbeliever.
You know, that's a great point there, because I think what you're saying, Dan, is that sometimes we get into the minutiae way too fast. And the non-believer from the outside, as you're relating it, he goes, "What? Hold it!" And we ought to just back off for a while, and say, I don't have to go there. We can say to ourselves and more important things to converse about at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, I just as a personal example of this, not necessarily with Young Earth, Old Earth, but a very similar conversation that takes place among apologists. This kind of old distinction or classical distinction between evidential versus presuppositional apologetics, you know, the evidential being there's reasons for belief. The presuppositional said all you got to do is preach Christ and you can't reason somebody into faith. And I remember, during my graduate school days, walking, it was me, a Lutheran, a Reformed, and then this unbeliever who liked to hang out with us. I mean, she generally liked to hang out and kind of listen to the conversations. But the amount of time and the amount of breath that I recall wasted on debating with the guy apologetic methodology regarding whether we should have a presuppositional approach or an evidentialist approach. Afterwards, I kept thinking, and I actually would email the guy, say, look, we got to stop doing that because, really we should be conversing with the unbeliever in our midst. But here we are talking to each other more than we're talking to her about why what qualms she might have with say Christianity.
That's a really good point. Maybe it's even the impetus, a thought starter for another article by you, kind of called you know, rude conversation where we kind of, what you're saying is we kind of forget who we want to really converse with, right?
And, yeah, and I like that. Yeah.
I like that too. And so lots of good articles and stuff out there about Apologetics 1517, The Legacy Project. I know when I just Google search 1517, it instantly comes up legacy, and that's it. So it'll get you there. So check it out, listener. I think you're going to like it. And go check out Daniel Dean, and you'll see the article that he talked about, Old Earth, New Earth, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater and forgetting who we're talking to, the non-believer. I like that.
Yeah, and since we're plugging it right now, we are actually tonight, let's see, this will be about 7 o'clock Pacific time.
So about 9 o'clock Central, 10 o'clock East, is
yeah.
that, yeah?
The Thinking Fellowship will be together having a kind of strategy. You know, we get together once a month and just meet and talk about what we're writing and things like this. But what we're starting to do is we'll open up and we'll let people know on Facebook, like we'll, on the 1517 Legacy Project Facebook page, we'll open a line of questions so that if anybody wants to kind of stop in and drop a question to us, we're all sitting together in a room talking about the you know, 1517 and the apologetic endeavor. And I can't promise we'll answer your question, but occasionally we do get into some, you know, some conversations right then and there with people through Facebook.
So if somebody yeah. out there maybe says, I'd like for you to write or think about this, or can you help me with this, that might be of interest to you guys sitting around your planning session.
That's right. Yep. Yeah.
We
want input. We need input from the people. Because in a weird way, all of us in the 1517 Project, you know, we are the kind of, and this is actually, you know, you talked about future posts. I've got a post coming out on kind of blue-collar apologetics. We're in the academy, and we're dealing with very kind of precise and technical sometimes and specific questions that are raised from our upbringing in the academy. But as we all know, those don't always aren't necessarily the same kinds of issues and problems that arise with somebody who's, you know, at the water cooler or at a sporting event or what, you know, just the kind of regular day in, day out life that is so important. And so we're really looking for ways to reach out and get people to throw their problems our way so that we can help and get a better sense of what the community needs.
Excellent. So all you out there listening, and even when they hear this on the archive, Dan, if you have, you know, thoughts on that, want some inputs to this great apologetics group at 1517, the Legacy Project, you know, by all means, communicate with them on Facebook, and there's a nice contact source right there on your website. Do that. And I know you guys would appreciate it, and the contributor would be blessed too. I think that leads in well to what we want to talk about today. This is the second of a talk about a formal debate jailbreak on apologetics and how beavers, the study of beavers, might help us to clarify some things and maybe even push us in a direction that sometimes we don't want to go. We did a first show on this, and so our listener out there, you can go on to our archives at kfuo.org, and our search engine's pretty good. I tested it. Just top every page, there's a little search box. Just type in beavers, and you'll get our first session. You can listen to that, and if you wait a while, the second one as well. Tell us, just so the people that didn't hear our first one, what could we possibly use with the study of beavers to help us as Christian apologists, Dan?
Yeah, so the first post, you know, the one that earlier that you've got up on your site and people can search for, you know, the kind of takeaway from that was just a looking into what the kind of an observation, I should say, really about what I see in the kind of educational world of apologetics, where when we're educating laity and ourselves and people around us, the kind of the undergirding model is one of kind of formal debate. You know, and William Lane Craig is great. I hope it didn't come across as I was picking on him in the post, but he's great because he's so good at it, right? I mean, he's really good at what he does. But it is just one aspect of the apologetic enterprise, returning to that kind of comment I made about a post I have coming up about blue-collar apologetics. You know, a lot of this stuff really happens around a water cooler. And our contexts are not the context of formal debate. And the tools that make formal debate work well aren't necessarily the tools that make a conversation between a believer and an unbeliever go well. And so I cash it out in kind of my training as a philosopher of science in a kind of, you know, abstract discussion of models and this is what gets kind of further clarified then in the second Beaver post. What are the natures of models and how the nature, when we build the models, we tend to give the models more truth, more value, you know, than the things the models are meant to explain. You know, the subjects the models are meant to explore. So like beavers. You know, we can talk about a fitness value, which is a biological term for how many offspring that the beaver is going to have. We can talk about the fitness value of beavers without ever observing, watching, getting acquainted with beavers. And that, so, to me, just seems odd, and I don't want that to happen in, say, the apologetic enterprise.
Sure. So without even understanding how beaver populations integrate and procreate, and what scenarios out there in the field that might be conducive to their population retainment or increase, these models might not be really good at that because they're sometimes not even connected with the real world of beavers. Is that kind of the gist of what you're suggesting?
That's kind of the gist, you know, and we see this. I mean, it's not to say that the models are bad, because we do need, the models help us organize our experience in the world.
Yeah.
But one that as an educator, again, that, you know, that I constantly hear about are the models we give, the sociological models of birth groups. And by that I mean, you know, we got boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, and now, they're, you know, right now they're fighting for the new generation, but it looks like it might go to be Generation IY is what they're looking to call it. And while these kinds of organizations are helpful at a first glance, they really provide a kind of, they allow us to be lazy. Because now we can look at the models and say, well, you know, I don't really have to talk to this person because they're a Gen Xer and I'm a millennial. And, you know, we just can't talk to each other because we have different backgrounds and experiences and all that, you know, all that jazz. And that's the model speaking, not really to individuals, right? And I worry that some of the apologetic literature out there and the copious amounts of kind of internet material on apologetics, it tends to support a view like that where you've got models of populations of people, and in a real way, the kind of moral complaint here is that makes us lazy, because now I don't have to get my hands dirty. I don't have to do the work. And what do I do when the model breaks down? I just, and by that I mean, what do I do when the person I'm talking with doesn't fit the structures of the model or the group that they're supposed to belong with? Then I'm at a loss, because I don't know how to talk to them.
Unless someone out there hearing us today, Dan, is going, scratching their head and going, I'm not sure what they mean by models. Now, I know, believe it or not, but my undergrad, I have a minor in economics, and I even took a neat course called econometrics, where I could not believe it that we applied calculus to supply and demand curves, and we put it into these exhaustive computer models where it would predict, you know, let's say if we change this little thing out in the economy, let's say the savings of this sector, what would it do to the overall GNP or something like that? And I know they use modeling a lot in meteorology to predict weather, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
are you using that in that same sense, Dan, a kind of mathematical computer model that you plug in these variants and it would predict some behavior like with beavers and in our case like with population groups? Is that kind of what you're talking about with modeling?
Yeah, I'm using model very broadly, but that's my background. That's the way I'm conceiving of a model, is a kind of mathematical or statistical tool that we use to help kind of predict and control the environments that we're in. So, for instance, you know, by observing you know, or looking into, you know, numerous instances of, say, beavers, we know that their genetic structure, the genetic structure, has a certain mutation rate, right? And I forget exactly what it is. It's in the text of the blog post, but it's something like 0.0012 or something like that. Meaning that every million of years, you're going to get that many mutations in the gene structure of a beaver. And like you were saying, with economic models, you hold certain things constant, and that allows you to kind of hypothesize what will happen if I tweak this or tweak that, or if my model isn't accurately describing the world, then maybe I have the wrong variables controlled for, and you've got problems with, you know, how do we ever come to grips with the model accurately or not accurately representing reality? And that's the kind of tension I'm drawing on, is that the models, while useful in helping us represent reality, are not the reality itself.
Excellent. Talk to us a little bit about one of the things that fascinated me, and I think it is a very important point that you're making, this linkage between the danger of, you know, the actual human being, in our case, that we do apologetics with, and the beaver and the beaver management side. What's the danger, especially for us Lutheran apologetes? And you know, thanks be to God, Dan, through 1517 and hopefully Cross Defense and some others, Lutheran apologetics is really starting to take off. I know where I go and talk and meet with people, especially young people, they're really starting to dig this apologetic thing, because it is a way to really have our Christianity meet the road, you know, to where we can try to do the thing we're supposed to do as Christians and interact with non-believers. So what's the caution, especially for us Lutheran apologetes and maybe even some other Christians that are getting into apologetics?
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad it's taken off with the young and you guys doing your surveys and finding out, you know, real estate, you guys are good at getting that kind of sociological data on who's interested in what topics, right? That's like, again,
sure,
again, a plug trying to get some information for us at 1517 by way of Facebook. You know, people send us your questions, young, old, you know, we want to know. And the young is what got me into apologetics. I mean, I was training to be a DCE and a youth worker in a Lutheran church, and apologetics really kind of said, "What, man, I wish I would have had this when I was 16 years old and asking certain questions." Right, but instead, the questions that were presented to me were more about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. To which, as a 16-year-old, I'm looking at it going, you know, you're going to lose on this one every day.
Yeah.
Right. But I have some serious questions about Christianity that no one's answering for me. Right. And the fear is, again, that because there are so many young and the minds are so impressionable and they're seeking answers, that when you look at the apologetic material, you're presented with just this barrage of information. And it does kind of come down, I mean, like I said, the undergirding factor of it all, I think, is more of an argumentative method or a formal debate, is the way I use it in the post. But one thing, the kind of take-home for the burgeoning apologist, the ones learning about this stuff, is that there is never going to be a perfect model for the apologetic enterprise, and this should come as no surprise to Lutherans, because we truly can't argue somebody into the faith. So any kind of way that we present a way of going about apologetics is going to have successes and failures, which indicates that your particular kind of relationships you build with these people need to also be cultivated as you're developing and thinking through the apologetic task. And the danger I point out in the text is that this, in a way, you start becoming friends with these people you're dialoguing with, right? I mean, I'm not talking about the one-off kind of on-campus, let's set up a booth and just have students come, we argue with them for 15 minutes or talk with them for 15 minutes about the nature of Christianity, and then we're on our way and we never see each other again. What I'm after is more of the kind of cultivation of relationship between friends. You know, you got college seniors who are going to go be living in dorms where they don't really have much say in who their roommate is their first year. They're going to experience a lot of weirdness out there in the world. But some of these people they meet are going to become genuine friends. right? And all of a sudden, we find ourselves in this awkward predicament, and this, you know, happens when I went out and studied philosophy. I've got these friends now who are literally perishing, and it scares me to death, right?
Sure.
So I cultivate a relationship with them, even when my apologetics and my talks about Christianity and Christ and his atoning work on the cross fail. You know, I've developed the relationship in such a way that, okay, well, so it didn't work, you know, that didn't go over so well, so we'll wait till the next opportunity I receive or whatever, right? But I can only do that because I've got multiple points of contact with these people.
And kind of linking this with where we kind of started with encouraging people to tune in to, you know, Facebook tonight when you and the other people there at 1517 Legacy Project are going to be talking, that, you know, many a times, you know, and I know you've seen this too, as I have, Dan, where someone really puts in some thoughtful work to prepare kind of a flow chart when you're trying to talk about Christianity or even the existence of God or something with a person, and the possible, okay, if they say it this way, you go over here and respond like this. And I hope that I'm hearing you kind of in that way, that sometimes that's what we Lutherans are really good at, you know, doing all that formally. And you're saying, break out of that, a jailbreak,
right.
when you're talking with you know, this friend that you make a friendship with, and you'd like to, you know, have the same Christian worldview and the confidence of eternal life in Jesus Christ. And so let's break out of that rigid thing. We don't have to memorize all that. And I would like your thoughts, too, in that regard, Dan, to something that's always kind of hit me, that I think Satan kind of does his biggest number on us Lutheran Christians, because a lot of times people tell me, Rod, you know, but you've spent years in thinking through this stuff and you got all this experience and I can't keep it all in my head. And my answer is, no, you don't need to keep it all in your head before you start, because the way you accumulate all this is to start talking. And
right.
You don't have to have a lot memorized, because if you're like me, then I go, gosh, I can't remember exactly where this goes next. Okay, well, I'll see you. I got to go. No, you just keep talking, and you learn things, right? And is that kind of where you want to take this, Dan?
Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, because you what philosophy is sometimes called the great conversation. And to borrow from a field that I'm much more familiar with than, say, strict theology or pure theology, you know, Socrates was, his big insight into the dialogues and the conversations he had, they were all about trying to define perfectly some sort of concept, virtue, piety, courage. And what I have to continually point out to the students is that Socrates actually, and this is where the analogy will probably break down with apologetics, but Socrates is actually not so much interested in providing the perfect definition of piety or virtue or courage. What gets Socrates so upset is when his interlocutor or the person he talks with gives up in the search for truth, goodness, and beauty. And so it's really a kind of a moral situation where Socrates has shown that the answers he's given aren't good, and then the guy, instead of saying, kind of redoubling his efforts and saying, all right, Socrates, let's dig in and try this again, the interlocutor, the person Socrates is talking with, just says, I'm out. I can't do this. This is too hard. And Socrates accuses, and I'll bring this back around in just a sec, but Socrates accuses these people of being lazy in their wisdom.
Mm.
And what I fear with a lot of the kind of apologetic literature out there is it allows us to become lazy in our wisdom, where, you know, I haven't studied this the way you have. I haven't read enough books. I haven't thought through my own faith carefully enough to be able to go present it to somebody else, you know, and I call this is a certain kind of laziness, and I think a fear that we're going to do something wrong that might actually cause harm to somebody.
Absolutely. Listen, let's do this. When we come back from this break, I'd like to take us off into a little tangent, but not much, I think, with some conversation that you share with us in your post here, Dan, on Charles Darwin, actually talking at the end of his book, Origin of Species, the grandeur of this view of life and its application to our Christian witness and apologetics. Stick with us. We'll be right back here on Cross Defense.
Hey, Pastor Craig D'Onofrio here. I want to thank you, my Drive Time friends, for all of the wonderful things that you've been saying about Reformation Rush Hour. It's a pleasure to spend your evening commute with you. If you haven't been listening, you've been missing some fantastic topics, guests, and lighthearted fun. So please be one of my Drive Time friends. Monday through Friday, 5 to 6 p.m. Central on Worldwide KFUO, 850 a.m. in St. Louis, KFUO.org worldwide.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Worldwide KFUO is easy to find on AM 850 in St. Louis and online at kfuo.org. Through our contacts page online, you can ask us questions, and there is good old snail mail, too. Our street address is KFUO, 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. The worldwide leader of confessional Lutheranism. Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news for more than 90 years.
Hi, I'm Joni Harwell. Worldwide KFUO is listener-supported, and you, the listener, are our funding providers. One of the best ways to help is by becoming a day sponsor. Pick an available date to mark a special event, or simply to thank our Lord for His many blessings. You'll find details at kfuo.org, then click on Support Us, or call Mary Schmidt, 314-996-1518. Help spread the gospel. Become a worldwide KFUO day sponsor.
The LCMS shares the good news of Jesus' incarnation, death, and resurrection with those in our own backyards, in urban, rural, and small town areas, and with Hispanic, Black, and other ethnic communities. This month, we are focusing on our national mission work. Join us in supporting this work. Find resources at lcms.org/themes/February.
Let Worldwide KFUO help you get the word out about your next church, school, or organization event. By including your event in the KFUO datebook, it will be announced on the air throughout the day. Send your event information via email to jennyw@kfuo.org. That's jennyw@kfuo.org. Or call 314-996-1515. Be sure to include date, time, location, and contact information. The KFUO datebook is a public service of listener-supported Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
What were the 16th century reformers' biggest objections to the papacy? And should Lutherans today still object? Monday on Issues, Etc., we'll continue our series on the Lutheran Confessions, talking with Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House about the power and primacy of the Pope.
Issues, Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
You've discovered Worldwide KFUO, a radio station where you can find the clear biblical understanding of Christianity proclaimed daily in both word and song. Our talk programs can be heard live or on demand at your convenience anytime worldwide. The KFUO talk programs proclaim the true Word of God, focused on salvation through Christ and Scripture alone. You've discovered KFUO.org, the messenger of good news.
And you're back with us here on Cross Defense, and we're glad you're listening. We're talking about, I think, a really interesting and, you know, functional, practical thing about our apologetics. A formal debate jailbreak that Beavers can help us with. This is part two of that talk with Professor Dan Dean. He's professor of philosophy at Concordia University Irvine, also contributor of 1517, The Legacy Project, where this second article about this is located, and we're using it as the basis today. So check all that out. Dan, we kind of teased going to this direction, and in your fine article here, you have headed up this little part with this nice headline, Beauty and the Clinical. And then you quote from some of the following, closing lines of Darwin's, masterpiece on the origin of species. Tell us about those final lines and kind of what it evokes for our apologetic task.
Yeah, well, I mean, those are just his last lines of the Origin of Species, where I feel, I mean, it really captures the fact that the guy, you know, whatever you think, again, about him and about evolutionary theory and whatever problems there might be with the theory itself, it really shows that he was, you know, he loved creation, and he loved it in a way that I think is shared by many scientists when, it's kind of what the motivating factor that pushes them into their work. But the love is for the nature and for the species and the great variety he sees in there. It isn't for necessarily his kind of his model of natural selection. Natural selection was a wonderful discovery on his part, and it made his career, and it started biology down this kind of path towards what we might call professional science in the mid-20th century. But what really got him out there was the fact that he just loved to go collect beetles, and he loved to observe these creatures and these species in their natural environments. And so I use this as a kind of picture to show what happened when science professionalizes away from the kind of just the picture of a naturalist or a natural historian or a natural philosopher, one who just kind of spends time in nature describing what they see, to the more model-based approach that we have now, where everything becomes very sterile and clinical, you know, and the ending lines of the article that I use as a kind of a foil regarding the beaver mitochondrial study, right, is very kind of classic of a way a science article ends. It just says, in summary, our study showed that the wide taxonomic range of glides, data sets comprising whole, and it just says that's what we found. And there's no hint of personality, of love, of you know, endearing kind of, there's nothing that would endear one to that picture of science. Whereas Darwin's ending lines still, you know, you'll read biographies of biologists, and they always pull on that and say, this got me into it. It was this kind of, there is grandeur in this view of life, and I'm studying it at its deepest levels, and this is what drew me into the scientific enterprise. So I would love that to kind of be our model for apologetics, where the people that we're talking with can't get enough speaking with us about these issues, even if they don't, you know, become Christians or something like that. The fact that they want to talk about it, right? It's kind of a breakdown of that natural barrier to reject these kinds of conversations. And we have to do it with a bit more. I think we need to do it with a bit more beauty, right? We've kind of lost this kind of Christian experience. Something we talk about in our campus a bit here is the Christian aesthetic, and we really don't. We don't have right now, I'll be bold enough to say, I don't think we have a true Christian aesthetic right now. Aesthetics being kind of, you know, the beautiful, if we're thinking in the classical philosophical categories, the beautiful.
Amen. I think you're right on there that when we're engaging with another human being, and we all know that one of the things that they can sense and flesh out pretty quick is whether we are really in... to just kind of have them as another specimen on our apologetic, history graph, mm-hmm. or if we really do care about them as a human that Jesus loved and died for and all the rest of the great gospel fulfillment for them. And so that's what you're saying is that ascetic, we should really be liking the people. And you know, if I might be so bold too to say that, you know, it appears to me that Jesus exhibited a profound love, passion for humans. I mean, you know, even on the cross, forgive them for they know not what they do. And I can, you know, the story after story we hear about him going around from village to village and talking to people, and then his apostles caught on to that, Dan, that what he was exhibiting that they ought to do too is go out and care for these people and give them truth in kind of special ways. And am I hearing you right that that's kind of it, is showing that same passion, that same aesthetic that Darwin had for those natural subjects that he was into? We should do that for the person that God puts into our path at the university or at some event just in our life, in our neighborhood, and so on.
Yeah. When you read, go back and read The Origin of Species, it truly is a kind of work of literature. I mean, it's science, you know, but it reads very kind of poetically almost. And, what people want, I think, and I'm just I'm a philosopher, so I could just sit back and say, this is what I think people want, you know. But I think people, they want to see two things out of the people that they're dialoguing with. If they're serious seekers, and there's always that question of whether or not somebody is just playing a game with you, you know, and prying on your kind of genuineness. But they want to see a genuineness of conversation, that, you know, you're not there to try to prove something to them or tell them that they're morally, you know, incapable or wrong or something like that. But then they also want to see a kind of genuineness in yourself, your own person. They want to know that you don't have all the answers, that you've struggled with this stuff, that the models, you know, they're models because they fail fail everybody, right? I mean, I have questions about things that I don't have answers to, all right? And when they can sense that you're actually a fellow struggler and not just somebody who's got all the answers for them, it really opens up the dialogue a bit more to go down some more fruitful paths towards, an eventual, hopefully, proclamation of the gospel.
Sure. Hey, would this be analogous, Dan, my undergrad was in business administration, as I said previously. I minored in economics and I majored in marketing. And we students always would sit around and talk that we could pretty well tell with a reasonable certainty which one of our professors had actually did the topic that he was teaching, if he'd actually did it in the real world or not. And then we'd check it out. And almost undoubtedly, we were always really good predictors, because the ones that had actually did the subject matter in the real world, like I remember one of our finance profs who had an amazing background, worked at Boeing and everything. And when he talked and told the examples, you know what dripped out of him was this guy had a passion for finance. And he put it so profoundly, so simply, and had real world examples where some of the others, we were like, man, that's theoretical, you know?
Right.
And you'd ask more probing questions, and it was like, I like your choice of words, sterile, clinical, and you're never really sure that that stuff had even been tested or used. And you were relating this to the scientific world, where I found it pretty fascinating. And I'd like you to comment on this if you think I'm on the right tangent, that you said one unusual aspect of the contemporary biological science field is that one need not ever venture into the field to actually see the beavers or whatever your natural subject is. That is so far from what Darwin was at, you're saying.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can sit, it's not true of all. I mean, then there's different branches of biology, of course. But for a lot of the molecular stuff, you don't really ever have to go live with or see the organism in its natural environment. You know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, and we have manuals upon manuals upon manuals, or textbooks upon textbooks of information about these animals, and we just go from there. Now, of course, there is some hands-on in the lab and things like that, but the idea was, my picture in the head as I was writing that was that you could spend your entire time in the lab, you know, ripping wings off fruit flies or doing genetic calculations on beaver genetics without ever going into the world to look at fruit flies as they actually behave, or look at beavers as they actually behave, which does seem just backwards or a long way from where we've come. And your point about kind of, you know, testing your profs in that way is truly why I think we don't need a lot of information to do, quote unquote, do apologetics. You just need some basic kind of facts that you're doing on this show. You have that apologetics 101, the kind of boot camp between Montgomery and Parton. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you can send people to over and over again to just kind of get the basics of the facts down. But what the harder work is, work that's going to be doing my idea of the apologist as a naturalist is getting out there and having the conversations with the different people and cultivating those relationships. Because as we left on the front end of the break, you know, that kind of Socratic dialogue mentality where you learn through the conversation, and you're going to learn from the people you're talking with what their specific needs, what their specific kind of problems are, and that might kick you back into the books to do a little bit more research for the next time this happens, or that might provide some different avenues that you weren't even aware existed, because the books that you're reading about apologetics or the lectures you're listening to never covered such topics. I always go, Lewis, when C.S. Lewis went and did his Mere Christianity, I think it was out in Russia, and I'd have to look it up. I think it was in Christianity Today. But they kind of they were reflecting on what he did, and he had said somewhere along the line that, you know, he had done a lot of research and thinking about the issue of Christianity and how he was going to present it to these soldiers, present it to the soldiers, and the questions they threw back at him were completely different than the questions he thought they were going to throw at him.
what he did without the real subject even involved was too sterile, too clinical again.
Yeah.
So it threw him for a loop, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But he's a master, so he of course could adapt with that kind of stuff. But that's kind of the mentality that I want to capture. That if
sure.
there's going to be a Lutheran ethos to the apologetic task, it's that, and not the kind of formal debate.
I don't know if I raised this with you or not, Dan, or so many of your fellows there at 1517, the Legacy Project, have blessed us here on Cross Defense. But I was saying with some of them, I know that many of your colleagues out there even have studied under Dr. Alistair McGrath, and I was so privileged to meet him at a conference where he was the keynote speaker, and he gave me like two interviews, and it was really wonderful. And I talked to him about a book that he had written called Mere Apologetics, because he feels like he might be the current kind of C.S. Lewis, because they have so many ties. It's unbelievable. Born in the same place in Ireland, and then they went on to they were atheists and then taught at Cambridge and Oxford and became Christian advocates. And so, he was relating to me how he really wants to communicate that apologetics is not just this getting out there and winning a debate and scoring these intellectual points, which, of course, he's really good at. And that's what amazed me and impressed me. But he was saying, you know, hey, your real task and passion here has to be to introduce them to your Savior, Jesus. Because he says, this guy's really cool, this Jesus. And he said, that's what we should be doing more of. And I was like, wow, coming from him, this is stark, and this is important. And I think we're going there with your idea of break out of this formal debate jail. We're kind of doing this backward, Dan, as you lay this out in your article. You know, why I raise this is you kind of, I think, chronicle for us how the biological world went from this passionate, hands-on awe and wonder and grandeur to pick at some of Darwin's own words about him being out there in nature, to this sterile, clinical, modeled environment where people could not even go out there and ever look at a beaver or the wildlife in the Galapagos Islands. And so is it important, and I think it is, that by your documenting what happened here in biology, the parallel in apologetics is something for us to be aware of and kind of break out of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, again, it is just awareness, kind of raising it as we're thinking through the foundations of how maybe Lutherans should be picturing, conceiving of the apologetic task. And this is partly because, you know, Lutherans for a long while have been very kind of antagonistic towards apologetics. And then also partly a reflection on the fact that the evangelical world has not been antagonistic to apologetics. And I worry that, again, I don't want us to kind of be lazy with our wisdom. In terms of just kind of, well, let me just take, I mean, I see this in, when I mentioned I was training to be a DCE, and I saw this time and time again where we just would kind of pick up the latest kind of evangelical literature on this topic and say, well, I'll just baptize it Lutheran, and I'll just make it Lutheran. And I'm sitting there going, well, we can do that, but why don't we want to think through these things from the ground up? You're given an opportunity to kind of sit back, being late to the conversation, and reflect a little bit. And maybe these are my philosophical proclivities, but we've been given an opportunity. Let's not just rush in and provide something that is kind of second rate because we're taking it from another tradition and Lutheranizing it. Let's think through this from the ground up.
I couldn't agree with you more there. And, we could even probably raise some examples over time where we have been guilty of doing just what you were giving example there, that we have tried to Lutheranize something that if we would have had better reflection and said, can we just modify this a little, or do we need to like start over and do it a Lutheran way? And I really think that you and some of your colleagues, Dan, are doing us such a great service in that of, sitting back and reflecting and say, since we're kind of new and late in this game, and we have something important to bring, and let's not in all of our brilliance and our wisdom take everybody down a wrong path, including ourselves. And so I think your raising these concerns are so important for us to stop and survey. I think maybe we could start here by asking you this. You, towards the end, you kind of say, I offer that we need to approach our apologetic task in the way Darwin approached the natural world, with a sense of reverence and awe at its amazing complexity. The person I am talking with is not a variable within an equation, but a living, breathing individual with hopes, dreams, anxieties, and a complex natural history. Boy, I know when I read that, Dan, I stopped and I said, yeah, exactly. And that's why, sometimes with an individual that I'm blessed to begin the apologetic task with, I never can say, okay, they fit into this mold or that sequence that I used before. It's like, wow, I know I can't start with the sequence I used the last time. I've got to go somewhere else because this person is displaying a different set of experiences and relationships and questions, and I've got to kind of shift. Am I close at all?
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, that's right. The idea again is that, you just kind of get out. You got to get in there and talk with these people because when we don't talk with them, God works through, of course, mysterious ways, and He works through He works through the world, right? And you will be amazed at the things that you can learn from talking with somebody who, you know, sitting down and actually conversing with them who is from a completely opposite side of the fence as you. And it's not second nature, or I'm sorry, it's not first nature for us to go outside of ourselves or go outside of our in-group. But when you do, you'd be a surprise at the things you can learn and the kind of reflections that will help then cultivate, you know, a stronger understanding of yourself and your place in this world by speaking with these people. You know, and their natural histories are not ours, are not yours. They're very different. And there's no way that we can kind of capture that and bubble, you know, shrink wrap it up into a specific model for dealing with a group of people or a new atheist or whatever, because they're always going to defy their behavior, like the beavers and the fruit flies and whatever else we can model biologically. Their individual behavior will always be different than the model itself.
Dan, you talk about admiring Darwin's tenacity and his care, and we could add in there, I think, his passion for attempting to understand the grandeur of the natural world. That would seem to have a huge implication for our apologetic task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it does. I don't quite – I'd have to think about where we could take the tenacity. I mean, I was kind of more on the passional side that we should actually, you know, love the lost.
I was thinking the tenacity there. Then you had another line about a task of proclaiming Christ is to keep the conversation going.
Yes.
That tenacity in wanting to talk more to that person. And just if I could maybe give an example to use as a foil here, I had a chance years ago to engage a man at a Thanksgiving dinner where we were both guests, and he heard I was this a Christian pastor who liked apologetics. And so he just attacked me in front of all my friends and my family. And I remember it was such an engaging conversation. And he started with, you know, his big beef was, I can't believe that any documents that humans wrote, like Paul and these other guys, could be anything other than human, you know, problems and all this.
Sure.
And so I kept on talking to him. And what impressed him was I said, look, we really can't do it, even if we sit here the rest of the day at Thanksgiving and talk, because I want to mingle with all these other people. I know you too. And long story short, I asked him if we couldn't continue the chat, and we did. And I just had a great opportunity to ask this friend who had hosted him and I at that Thanksgiving, how whatever happened in my conversation. He said, Rod, he went home, but before he did, he always said, that little guy Rod really did a number on me, that he really wanted not to let me go and just kind of win that night, which he thought I had with my defense of the reliability of Scripture. But I wanted to really engage him in a long term. Is that the tenacity of Darwin that might apply here?
Yeah, it needs, I mean, I think the way I say it in the article is it takes many points of contact. And I know a lot of this actually is kind of out of our control, right? Because it depends on, you know, there's a time and place for setting up a booth on a college campus and just kind of doing one-off apologetics with people. But I think for most of us, we have a pretty steady, there's a steady supply, or that's probably the wrong way to say it. There's a steady group of unbelievers that we kind of mingle with daily, right? And these are the people we work with. These are the people we see at the shopping market because we shop at the same times or something like that, right? These are the people we see at the park as our kids are running around. And those are, I think, the underrepresented kind of aspect of apologetics, because in those contexts, debate and things like this, they just don't work there unless the person wants to become, you know, they want to really debate you. But more often than not, they just want to sit and chat and talk.
And converse over a long time. And that music means we ran out of time, Dan. You believe it? It was so great having you on again. God bless. Keep up the good work out there, Concordia Irvine and 1517. Let's do this again.
All right, we'll do.
Blessings
to
you, Dan.
You too.